$233 billion. That's the total all-in New York State budget Governor Hochul proposed for next fiscal year, 2025. And that's the talk of the town in Albany right as we speak, as the state's executive and legislative leaders work to come to a budget agreement for April 1st, the beginning of the new fiscal year. But what is the state's fiscal situation? Does the state have the capacity to reverse the governor's proposed Medicaid and education aid savings like the legislature wants? Will the state raise taxes, and if so, which ones? And how would that affect the state's ability to attract and retain residents and businesses? All critical questions, and we are fortunate enough today to listen to a conversation with one of the main people negotiating this budget. Hello, I'm Andrew Ryan, president of the Citizens Budget Commission, and thanks for joining us for another episode of What's the Data Point? Today, you will listen to a conversation I had on February 15th with New York State Budget Director Blake Washington, which helped to set the stage for the budget negotiations occurring right now. We discussed the state's overall budget picture, including details of the state's large structural budget gap. We talk about the need for more sunlight with basic financial plans so the public and legislators alike can know what actually is being debated and decided. We also talk about Cap and Invest, New York's in-development emissions reduction, carbon taxing and trading program that will have a massive impact on New York State's economy and the environment for the next 30 years. I hope our conversation gives you a clearer view of the state's current fiscal picture, as well as a look ahead to the challenges on the horizon.
Thank you very much for having me, and thank you everybody for being here today.
So how are you doing? Are you feeling balanced?
As a life goal, yes, I feel balanced.
We consider that a life and a state goal, you know.
And as a state goal, I feel balanced as well. But yes, I feel pretty good today.
That's, you know, I was Blake G. Washington. I kind of hope that G stands for good budgets, but I'm sure that your parents weren't actually thinking ahead like that.
No, they weren't. But it does not stand for George. It stands for Gregory. My mother's maiden name.
Really? I'd never thought about... No, I'm just... Yeah. Sorry. You know, this has been your life, of course. Right. Of course. I didn't actually think of that. I thought about good budgets, literally. But then again, that's why your boss, the governor, made fun of me during our fireside chat. She said, do you have a life? Which I considered a badge of honor, her making fun of me. But I looked at Robert, you know, your predecessor, a couple of generations, and I said, is this what it's like up there? So as we start, you know, to break the ice... Can you tell me one pleasant surprise about being budget director now that you're in this incredibly powerful position that people talk about? How has your quality of life been affected?
Interesting. Well, I'll say there's two. I'll say two immediately come to mind. First and foremost, my staff are just so wonderful. I mean, we have 290 staff, all who've been there for a long, long time. And they're just so wonderful. They're so bright and brilliant in what they do, and they anticipate stuff. So for a budget director that's, you know, new to the job, coming in the morning and having stuff before you that you're actually reacting to because they saw it the night before, and sort of when we have a dialogue with them, if I say something a little bit edgy, they'll bring me back. They'll tell me how things really work. A number one, just working with that team has been wonderful. And then on a lighthearted note, the surprise for me, added bonus, is my bathroom, my workspace, you know, has like everything self-contained, including a bathroom.
Have to leave.
Yeah. So my team said, hey, can we put a printer in your office? And I said, oh God, no, please don't do that. I'll never leave this place. So I have to leave, you know, and print my materials.
Well, you know, we're trying to reduce our use of paper.
In a refrigerator. All self-contained.
Fantastic. So you come in, listen, recession, fears of recession have subsided, you know, receipts are better than previously expected. You put together a budget, balanced, of course, in the out year still, even with those receipts, there's a $9.9 billion gap. 2028, we look at that, of course, that's reduced by one shot, so $3.5 billion of prepaid expenses, and there are, as in law, temporary tax increase that'll go away. So we look at that and we say, well, that's 9.9, but it's really like a $16 billion structural problem. On the other side, New Yorkers have needs and desires, and there are plenty of challenges, as I mentioned, to affordability and housing, as the governor has led in her proposals on. Could you tell us
What was your biggest challenge going into crafting this budget, and what was your strategy to address it?
I think the biggest challenge is just the gap itself. So I came in, I started in, Governor Hochul appointed me in August, so then we moved into a mid-year process, which we put out a report in October. So from the moment I started through October, we worked with our team just to start to, at that time we had a budget deficit that was double the 4.3 we have today, it was roughly 9. So our team at that time started engaging with state agencies to say, well, what are you doing? Are we able to maintain savings? Does this contract have to go forward? Is this, what's the timing on this contract? Are you hiring under the pace that was originally intended? So first coming in, just trying to squeeze the gap a little bit downward so that we have a more sane conversation. The executive budget coming in with a $9 billion gap is very challenging to stakeholders, challenging to the legislature for sure. So just finding first and foremost the low-lying fruit to get to 4.3 was difficult. And then the real fun began on the gap that remained. As you said, New Yorkers have any number of needs, and our two biggest areas of need are school aid and Medicaid, and they comprise an outsized portion of our budget. So trying to trying to close that $4.3 billion in gap by maintaining essential services and trying to find the areas of finesse where you're not taking a hammer to as much of state-aided programs as possible, that was the biggest challenge. But it was offset by the fact that seeing the governor's process and the way that we worked with her, our team sat with the governor for 20 hours or more, going through slide decks just like we would do with our own staff, and the level of engagement, at least from our policy wonk side, financial plan and capital and debt on the governor's mind, just her grasp of that and her willingness to really kind of get into the weeds with that was really gratifying from a staff perspective. All the other issues are heady and tough and things that you have to get into as well, but I think so closing the gap, number one, was the most sort of challenging part to do.
And can you, and let's start to drill down, because that's a great frame for our conversation. Let's, on the economic revenue side, what is your forecast of the economy? How conservative are your revenues forecasted right now? Or receipts, we should say, better?
So when we put out the budget, in last year's budget, we took about $10 billion out of revenue forecast post-pandemic, because the state of New York, like any other state or the federal government that has a PIT, a personal income tax, we witnessed precipitous declines. So from the time the budget was put out last year to enactment, we took $10 billion out. When the governor put out her budget last month, we put $2.2 billion back in just from income realization. There's even some upside coming into the end of next month, where we do forecast revisions with the legislature,
which are due the day after the gala.
So I think last year there was the division budget tends to align with blue chip consensus data. We're steady as she goes at this time. Looking at the fundamentals, there's a lot of upside. GDP has been revised by a whole host of forecasters. We tend to agree with that, sort of on the gross national level. The state is still clawing back from the recession in many ways, from the pandemic in many ways. Our jobs in the city of New York have returned, but rest of state still lagging behind.
Thank you.
So I think in general, we have a positive economic outlook. It's one that's different than last year, where we saw, and many other advisors saw, recession on the horizon. That's not so much of a near-term item right now, but there are dark clouds ahead, of course.
Yeah, no, there's both the look ahead and the dark clouds that every budgeteer always is thinking about, because that's part of your job and what everyone counts on. And I think that segues well into the conversation. We have hybrid work,
yes,
especially in the city, that affects us. Out-migration during the pandemic, which seems to have slowed, but affects us. And the increase in non-resident tax filers.
Yep.
That's grown. So people are living elsewhere. They have some income in New York, but more and more people who are filing taxes. These all kind of indicate how threatened our competitiveness for businesses and people are. On one side, there's a lot of discussion, as I said, about affordability and housing. On the other side, there's discussion about taxes. We have the nation's highest top personal income, combined personal income tax rate, the highest corporate franchise tax rate. We just put out a report in terms of combined state and local taxes and spending, where we're number one or number two. Frankly, you don't want to be either, but we are number one and number two. How concerned is the administration about New York's high taxes?
The governor has been very, very focused on this. The governor has, I don't know if she's seen your report just yet, but she, I'll certainly update her on it. Thanks for sharing it earlier, or last week. The governor remains very concerned. In her budget this year, we do not have an increase in the personal income tax. We have, actually have one tax increase in the budget. It relates to harmonizing the Airbnb hotel motel tax to the hotel motel tax. But beyond that, the governor wants our state to remain competitive. I think one of the first things when we were talking about our economics before, one of the things she locked into when we were briefing her on budget was just our jobs creation. That just seeing the stark difference between the city of New York, how long it took for the city to rebound post-pandemic, and then finding that the state of New York, rest of the state, is still lagging so far behind, as I said a few moments ago. So the governor believes strongly that you're not going to change that trajectory by larding on taxes to whether it be on the PIT or other sources of revenue. That statewide competitiveness is key for us to grow out of the pandemic, to continue to grow out of the pandemic. And so there's just no, when we look at the facts before us, and we think it's time to rationalize our state spending to the resources that we have. Last couple of years, we have not, for a variety of reasons, we've well exceeded our using federal aid, using some other resources. We've exceeded trends of spending across the state platform. And this is a year where we're trying to just get back to basics. What do we have? What can we spend? And, you know, and find a real balance between the two without raising taxes.
And, you know, that'll be part of the negotiation. We've already heard from the legislature. We'll come back on the spending side. But so she's committed to holding the line on that during the negotiations. And we certainly hope we can come back at the end. We certainly hope that she's committed to letting those temporary tax increases expire in 27 as they are. That'll take a trajectory change in state spending. But let's talk about state spending a little bit. So, you know, I had a dip in my state, a gap in my state budget watching career. When I started, my first CAFR that I looked at was then it was called the Comptroller's Annual Financial Report, $63 billion all funds. When you became Secretary of Assembly Ways and Means, I believe that the all funds budget was, Patrick just told me, was $144 billion.
Right.
So we're up about, in your proposal, about $90 billion in 10 years since you started. In the last 3 years, state operation funds, kind of what we take out of the state to run the government, increased 7.9% annually, scheduled to go around 4% in the future. We look at this year's budget gap. We both do adjustments, and thank you for those adjustments. But it's the spending is bigger than that this year. So you've made some efforts to control spending, as you said, in the big two, in Medicaid and education aid. Could you tell us a little about what your efforts are to restrain? Let's start with education aid, what you're doing in there, what's being proposed, and how that plays out.
Sure. You know, just a funny anecdote, though, from when I started to where I am today. I actually, when I was leaving, I was unpacking some stuff to go to the executive branch, and I found a report from a member of the audience here today named Dean Fulahan, and it was from when he was at a time well before I started the assembly.
He was your boss, right?
He was my boss indeed, and his report was half of that 122, so sometime in the 80s. So it's really stark, you know, you just start to see that sort of, that trajectory. But I got a kick out of that when I saw the report, and his same penmanship was in the same document. But so in school aid, over the last handful of years, record amounts of state and federal dollars have gone into our public schools. If you just take away this year, the previous 3 years, the state invested $7 billion in new funding for public schools. At the same time, roughly, the federal government put $13 billion in new resources in public schools. So $20 billion in public school aid has gone, has flowed to the districts in just the last, you know, handful of years, 3 years or so. So looking at that and knowing that most of the districts now on their reserves, you know, they're very healthy reserves, both statutory and non-statutory reserves. The budget tries to, again, acknowledging a $4.3 billion gap, it tries to adjust for some of the otherwise planned spending. So first and foremost, we allow for the foundation aid formula to run, but we adjust downward the CPI level that it would have run at. So by about 2 percentage points. Then we came under and we looked at the school aid formula. So, and we looked at this provision that's called the hold harmless provision that relates to what any district can get in any given year. There's 673 school districts in the state of New York.
But who's counting?
Yeah, but who's counting? What the state policy has been for time in memoriam is, well, you know, we'll run the school aid formula this year, and no matter what the formula yields, if you had population loss, if you have lesser needs, the state formula for 15 years has just said, well, you get at least what you got last year. And so what that's done is it's created this complete distortion in the school aid formula list where, you know, more and more districts are becoming on the hold harmless list. They're getting the same amount that they got last year, despite, you know, precipitous pupil loss, certainly in upstate New York. And the more people that become on the hold harmless list, the less resources you have for districts that are growing or districts that have high needs. So sort of the peanut butter on toast approach, this budget tries to adjust for that, to not just make sure that everybody gets something, but to make sure we're targeting the needs to the highest need districts and to the ones that are growing. So those are the two chief items that we accomplished that we put forward in the executive budget.
And, you know, CBC has been active in this area doing analysis and making recommendations, and we've argued for years, so thank you very much, that the hold harmless is not is both increasing our spending and not allowing us to direct resources to those places in need. How do you think this plays out in negotiations? This is, you know, you've sat on the other side of this. Yes. Table. I don't know how many members you had at what time, but in your majority, and you've heard of this. How do you think this plays out, having sat at both sides of the table?
Well, I'll say if there's one unifying force in this year's executive budget, you know, among, you know, things that brought both parties together, it would have been the hold harmless provision.
Congratulations.
So, yeah, winning. I think that obviously the legislature, and we look forward to engaging them. The device that we put forward is a blunt instrument, as I say. There's definitely some vagaries in there that are just hard to get at by sort of just cutting it off all at once. I think of a lot of these small rural school districts that there is no tax effort that can actually support educational services for those young pupils. The governor has certainly been very sensitive to that. And I think those are some of the things we have to smooth out over time. What we want to do is, obviously, we're starting this dialogue so we can start to get on a trajectory where we say, well, how many pupils do you have, and how can we start to wind that down? It doesn't have to be over 1 year, but as some people in the outside world have said, well, you know, Blake, you know, you're taking 20% away from a district because they lost 20 kids. I mean, this is crazy. And the data we're looking at, it's not 20 pupils. It's 200. It's 600. It's 1,000 pupils that have left since the formula has been created, and it's just, it's distortive, and it takes away from the
thing. Did you ever do an analysis to say if there wasn't a hold harmless for 15 years, what it would have looked like?
We've seen, I don't know if we've compounded it to just sort of see what
it's
a good question. I'll have the team look into it, because we know generally the excess, but at the same time we're looking at this, you, as I said before, just district reserves in general are, there's good government reserves that and good business reserves that people must maintain for just good, makes good business sense. And that's why the state law allows for that. But then there's, in the last couple of years, not just related to the hold harmless districts, but $1 billion in funds that are outside of any reserves that are just sort of, that's moving around the school aid, all the public schools. So there's just a time to have a rational conversation of what we can do and sort of harmonize where the resources are.
And might we suggest our research before, we've also advocated for moving some of the expense-based aids into the foundation aid formula so that you could better target aid to the districts in need, as well as, and you were talking about local effort of those districts who have difficulty small rural districts. We've actually focused some analyses on the fact that, as if you haven't been steeped in this, the state constitution guarantees every student a sound basic education. There's a funding formula that says that we're talking about that actually is enough money to give every student a sound basic education. And we have found that the state gives over around $2.4 billion to districts that already fund a sound basic education with their own resources. Do you think this is the trajectory we could go to both better allocate resources and bring that out your budget gap down?
I mean, in a perfect world, perhaps, but this is a very imperfect world because a lot of the districts you're referring to are, Long Island and the Mid-Hudson, and there's strong political representation in both sides of the legislature. It gets more dicey, for sure. But your analysis is not wrong, right? There, mm-hmm. There are districts where we saw this a lot in my prior life, particularly when we did the property tax. The state of New York has a property tax cap outside of the city of New York. But we saw that in some of these districts, something like a Westchester County, stands to reason if they increase their property tax by 0.02%, they can drive another $10 million to their district. Somewhere upstate, they can increase their property taxes by 25% and maybe get $2 million. So there are inequities, and there's that local effort that we sometimes are, the local school districts are very fortunate to have it. But to your point, they probably, in a perfect world, have enough of the resources to provide the sound basic education without the state, but in an imperfect world where the state wants to make sure that we're equitable and we're providing resources across the board, this is the result that yields.
So turning to the other big one, Medicaid. Mm-hmm. So education's challenging, Medicaid's tough. State spending's gonna grow in the financial plan 7% a year. It's obviously outstripping. It's high, we spend more than other places, and it's growing. What's the strategy to rein in New York spendings, particularly where we're an outlier and it's growing? Long-term care, home and community-based services, these are obviously big chunks where we are an outlier and they're growing.
So I think we have a sort of current year and a multi-year strategy. I think the multi-year relates to just, we have a whole series of actions in the executive budget where we try to target spending items that in a perfect world we would maintain, but in this very imperfect world we're unable to. And some of those actions are against industries or would be taken out against industries that are represented in this room or other sort of stakeholders throughout the health platform. I think this current year, what we're trying to do is at least get to a state where we have some sort of balance of just stopping the growth, or maybe staunching the bleeding, I guess, is really what we're trying to get at. So there's a few different measures in the executive budget that try to take out some of the nice things. In a perfect world, we'd keep them in, but those are eliminated. We don't necessarily change recipient benefits in the executive budget. And I think that the governor has engaged a couple of different panels. In the last handful of months, she appointed a commission on the future of healthcare, which is going to get under the hood and provide some data for the legislature, for the world at large to see, like, what does the state of New York do well? What do we do not so well? How do we relate to other states, peer states, to inform that decision? Because I think a lot of those discussions are important to have, and they're going to come to bear in the 26 budget, which is next year. But I think that you can't really have those discussions sort of in a vacuum. It can't just be everybody shooting off the hip and saying, this is what's wrong with hospitals, this is what's wrong with long-term care. The panels appointed with a bunch of experts in their field, academia, people that have run public health systems. So we're eager to hear what those results are, I think, into the long term. Because as you said, the numbers are not on our side. This budget is as much a projection, a reflection of state demographic shifts as much as anything else. Mm-hmm. We have an aging population. We have more and more utilization on long-term care. We have fewer school-age children, so that reflects itself in lower education. We have fewer college students, so it reflects itself in higher education. SUNY and CUNY both have even pre-pandemic, have mm-hmm. had some real, some campuses are down 40%. in pupil count. So this budget sort of looks at all of that and tries to just hold the line for the moment. We have some tough decisions that are going to have to roll out in the next handful of years.
And of course, we have a safety net system that has its challenges that the state has been patchworking, you know, each year, and that grows, so it's tough. But you do have a federal waiver.
Yes.
Which is going to bring in, if I understand, $6 billion of federal money. It's interesting in this discussion, I hear about the proposals for reductions, but I don't hear about where that money is going. Is that going to help you stabilize the system as you transition it?
Yes, it should. So on the day that the State of the State was, the governor delivered her State of the State, we got approval from CMS that same morning, so it was like a breath of fresh air. There's three different components to the waiver. The first relates to providing new payments to the hospital systems, about $500 million each year for the next handful of years. There's some new payments for the healthcare workforce. And then the balance, the biggest part of it, is relates to health-related social needs, mm-hmm. which are, as you would surmise, you know, nutritional supports, supportive housing. So I think the goal of the waiver is to try to improve patient outcomes, certainly on the health-related social needs. If people are addressing some of their everyday needs in the community, maybe there's less stress onto the hospital systems. Their care can be delivered in a more outpatient setting, or maybe not at all if they're eating well or housed. The waiver tries to look at a continuum of services for both. It provides relief for the state, but it also, it's really targeted more so towards the consumer and their experience. So we're excited to see what the outcomes are.
Having started a PPS in the first district waiver, and I'm not sure where the $8 billion improved our system, I'm looking forward to progress on this one. Let's turn to migrants and asylum seekers.
Sure. But I would say you're right. That's like, your comment is well, if I can, is well-founded, right? So I've been in the legislature 20 years. We've had two Medicaid redesign teams, $10 billion Medicaid waiver. And I don't know that anybody with a serious sort of...
And yet our health outcomes aren't improving and our safety net system isn't stronger.
Right. So something's wrong. Obviously, we have to kind of... I think that's where the governor... That's informed the governor's process. Wait, let's just take a step back. Let's get a real assessment of the facts on the ground, and then we can actually make some informed decisions here, because something is not working. And we all have some, strong ideas of what those are, and based on the spending and the fact patterns before us, but putting some light and some transparency around that is really important. So because it seems like a lot of these investments have not necessarily bore fruit. So sorry for.
No, thank you. Migrant asylum seeker spending.
Yep.
Big issue, real, both the program services and human issues, but obviously we're focused a little on the budget. The mayor came up and said, well, the feds aren't really ponying up. We should be splitting between the city and the state 50-50. What do you think?
Well, I think no city in this nation should have to bear this alone. I think the mayor has been doing a wonderful job in doing the best that he can, and his administration have really worked hard to stem the tide and to address the needs as they're evolving each and every day. Similarly, no state in this nation should do this alone. That's why the governor has been going down. She's been down in D.C. any number of times. She's on the phone, you know, three times a week, or you know, with any other stakeholder to listen. You must help. You must rationalize this process at the border. In the interim, you must provide resources to the states so that we can, to the states and municipal governments, so that we can actually address the needs that are before us. Having said that, the state budget, we provide a whole host. We provide $2.4 billion, as you know, to address the migrant crisis. That was $1.9 billion last year. We provided that amount within the means of, again, what we have to spend and what we have on hand and what we're able to spend. Being in this role, sometimes you have to, and you know this all too well, you have to kind of look at the whole state platform and figure out where you spend money, and that, you know, could you do more on one area? Could you do more on other areas? In a silo, you'd want to make sure that every need in the state of New York was met. But you have to sort of... target the expenditures where to meet the sort of exigent circumstances. So What we have is $2.4 billion. $1.1 billion goes to the city of New York for its public assistance expenditures. About $600 million goes to support 100% of the costs of provisioning care at Floyd Bennett Field, Randall's Island, and Creedmoor. And the balance is a whole host of things: National Guard mission, casework, case management, legal services, some other public assistance expenditures. But we're doing the best we can do, again, growing $500 million year over year and supporting the mayor in any way that that he sees that we were able to.
So let's turn to an area that you're very familiar with, the negotiations with the legislature.
Yep.
Your proposal is your adjustment is a 4.5% increase. We put more stuff on budget. We think it's a 5.7% increase. But there's, you know, some real spending increases in the budget year over year, yet you know that the legislature is always, and different members have talked about, you know, universal child care, more on expanded child tax credit increase, Medicaid, SUNY, CUNY, buses, you name it. What's your strategy to hold the line on the legislature? Because that out-year budget gap is already pretty big and the structural problem's bigger.
Well, I think so at the end of the month, we're all going to, the legislative secretaries I'll meet with them to define what the box is. The governor's here. Do we have any revenue growth? Are there abilities to introduce new spending into the governor's financial plan? If that domino falls, yes, no, whatever those resources are, then you can use some of those resources to smooth over some of the rough edges, whether it be on the school aid run or some of our Medicaid actions. The legislature will have resources to do that. I think from our perspective, the more sort of non-recurring items, the better. In any budget negotiation, you want to make sure that the base is covered and that we're not going up too far where we're just paying for it in the out years. But generally, I think just the process of dialogue and negotiation with them will bear fruit.
And not to gloss, just to call attention to what you said, your point is there might be more revenues, mm-hmm. and that could facilitate more spending. We can debate whether we can afford the law on it.
Yep.
Would you be committed to making sure that any added spending to above and beyond the executive would be below or max out at that additional revenues?
Well, that's the goal, right? So the state law requires that we have this revenue consensus process. We come upon a number, and then that's the number that you carry into the process. Does it always end that way? No, right? In all candor, but you want to keep it as close to that number as possible. Through the process of negotiation, everybody has to give a little bit, whether it be on the policy or on the spending. Everybody has to sort of get in this place where the leader and the speaker are able to engage their conferences and say, here's the package, here's what we think you're able to vote upon. And it's, you know, and the governor just looks forward to having that dialogue with them. But really with the mind of these out-year gaps are not going to get any better and without actually some level of restraint in the current year.
And speaking of the proposals, and you've done this on the other side well, so you're a perfect person to help us understand more. CPC has always advocated that there should be basic financial plan tables with the one-house budgets.
Yeah.
Yours actually last year got better, so thank you. Still wasn't a full financial plan in the out years. It seems rational that when the legislature is talking about adding spending and you have this envelope, that the only way to really represent what that means in the long run is those financial plan tables. Does that make sense, and should the legislature put those out with their one-house budgets?
100%. Any level of transparency is good. We would welcome any of that. I think that everybody should put their cards on the table and demonstrate how they close the gap. Everybody should show how they actually finance the things we do. We, in the legislature and the assembly side, we tried hard to put it out there. Now, all those ideas weren't always, some of them were political ideas, right? Some of them, but we at least showed the math. And we think it's very, very important to do because it's also both sides of the ledger. I remember even 10 years ago, when I first started as secretary, we're doing our financial plan and our partners in the Senate would not. And we'd have lots of increased spending that we would show and people would say, tisk, tisk, tisk. And then the Senate would have all sorts of tax decreases, right? So on net, it's the same result. Like we're spending $3 billion more. They're, you know, shedding $6 billion in revenue. So it's just this weird dance. And it also, I think in general, when people actually, when legislative parties partners are able to put a financial plan before the people, people can compare and contrast. But the people that I'm talking about comparing and contrasting, respectfully, are even the legislatures. The legislators, they have to actually say, well, this was a good idea, but did they pay for it? Oh, they didn't? Oh, well, maybe it was too good to be true. Or so just to have that actual rational dialogue around this, you know, I would salute them if they do it.
Yeah, we've also said at the enacted budget, like in the city, there should be basic financial plan tables. Now, the state does a great report 30 days later, but when the budget's adopted, we got a press release with a couple of numbers.
Yeah.
Could this be the year that there is, with the enacted budget, of basic financial plan table, so the legislators, as well as all of us, could know what the implications of what was just agreed and voted on is?
We always give it a college try. It's always like in the fog of war where you're kind of negotiating this. The nobody runs unless they're chased in budget making. And so everything...
Hold on, we're going to write that down because that's our job, I guess, so the chasers. Go on.
Everything comes to the very last moment. And our team, I mean, they watch these data like hawks. There's nothing that's getting by us.
Exactly.
But it's just a matter of capacity of actually landing the plane within the truncated time period. But we remain committed, the governor remains committed for sure, of giving as much transparency to this process as possible.
And let's go back to a second, and people have questions, but so we had, as I mentioned, Doreen Harris and Basil Seagos here, and we talked a lot about cap and invest, and yeah. CBC has been a long-standing supporter of using market-based mechanisms to figure out the most cost-effective greenhouse gas reductions. Mm-hmm. Of course, the state's invest system is going to raise some money. It was a little eye-popping when we saw the preliminary, you know, for comment. So this is not a done deal. I'm not saying the preliminary analysis showing that the first year would raise around $4 billion a year from the system, and it would grow by 2030 to $10 to $12 billion. This is like the biggest, in effect, tax increase we would ever have seen. Now there are goals, and there's not necessarily a plan to distribute that money. Have you looked at that? Does that concern you in the same way that other taxes that we were talking about concern you?
Absolutely. I mean, I'll say this just to take one step back, is that the regulatory or the statutory framework for cap and invest puts all the onus on the governor of the state of New York to actually come up with a whole host of taxes to fund it. The legislature took themselves out of it. I was part of the legislature just, you know, 6 months ago. So, you know, I guess I'm pointing at myself with the other three fingers, right? So the legislature took itself out of it. The governor, under law, must put forward some ideas that get at the cap and invest proposal. So that requires a whole host of decisions that are really not wonderful for an ordinary taxpayer in the state of New York. If you look at the scoping plan from a handful of a year ago when it came out, even the scoping plan for the environmental plan said, well, you know, in order to meet our climate goals, we'd have to have, I think it's 2 million homes electrified by 2030. I mean, I don't know of anybody that's done it, personally in the rest of state New York, like wholesale re-engineering.
The other 17 million people.
and then you'd need another, I think it was 3 or 5 million EV vehicles on the road, you know, sure. But we just saw this week that even my fantasy Ford F-150 Lightning pickup truck that my wife won't let me get, even those orders are down, they're not doing them. So there's a market forces. And this is all to say that it's the market itself in many ways that has to solve for some of this. The IMF did a report a handful of months ago and said, you know, if nations are looking at changing the climate, there's no way that any single nation can just finance this on its own. No, there's not enough debt in the world to do what people are talking about. How do you influence behaviors? How do you get consumers to care about it? How do you nudge them in their daily life to kind of get to the place where we need to be? And if it's not occurring under state law, we have to lead and put some items on the board to get resources to address the climate crisis. So the taxes that will be required to do some of to follow the goals are not inconsequential, and certainly the governor is certainly uneasy with the amount of investment that would be required here. But at the same time, she's very much committed to having a clean environment and doing anything in the state's power to change the trajectory as well. So it's going to be an iterative process. Looking forward to engaging the legislature, see if they want to. By the way, they give themselves the ability to put out the tax revenue, just no ability to, they didn't say what the taxes should be, but they said that they should come back and we should come back and have them allocate
and
the proceeds.
As people get ready to raise their hands, I just come back to our transparency point, because people are talking about the economic benefits of spending the money. But if you're taking $10 billion out of another set of, there's another set of analyses that say what is happening there.
Yeah.
And the transparency would be both sides of that, the opportunity cost and the impact. And so, you know, those are the kind of analyses we're always urged to be done and considered strongly. So why don't I look, 100%. We'll take a couple of questions from our trustees. Do I see any hands? It usually takes a second. Peter Hine.
A specific follow-up concerning Medicaid and home health care, where I believe New York is way out of line compared to other states. I see these commercials urging people, urging grandmothers to hire their granddaughters, who will then get paid instantly after each shift. It strikes me that this is a huge area of abuse in plain sight. Is this something being focused on?
Glad you asked that question. It's timely. Yes. I think, take a step back. You're relating to the CDPAP program, which is consumer-directed personal assistance program. It was established in the state law many years ago. And it's a very valuable program for persons that have profound disabilities and do not want to be institutionalized. We want these consumers to remain in our community. We want them to live with their families in any way to help them. We think it's a win-win-win. It's a win for the consumer. It's a win for the state. It's a win for sort of public policy. Unfortunately, over time, the mission of the program has changed. There was a state law change back in the late 2000s where we allowed for family members for familial caregiving and to be reimbursed by the state of New York. Not all of that is bad. But you can start to see in the last handful of years, we've had 1,200% growth in CDPAP. And it's an area that the governor is very concerned about. And we're concerned not only because of the sort of the example you provided, but we're concerned that this sort of what we're doing here by having widened the net so greatly is we're inviting abuses to the system. We're hurting the program that we value for the consumers that need it the most. And it comes at the expense, even worse, of all the other things that we have to invest in. We have hospitals in crisis. We have nursing homes that are not funded well. You have primary care that's not funded well to the extent that people would want, I should say. Any number of needs are still out there. Any number of requests will come from the legislature. But to meet some of those, you have to actually look at under the hood. What are we spending money on, and is this the right public policy approach? So I think you're going to see a little bit more of that from Governor Hochul. We have our 30-day amendments coming out today. It's something we're very, very concerned with. We won't change it overnight, but I think that over time, it's something that must be addressed.
And I saw Mark Willis and then Kent Haichu. And please raise your hand.
Thank you for being here. Another aspect of the budget that we haven't talked about is tax expenditures. Obviously, we've shown a great interest in that from the Citizens Budget Commission and taking a hard look at the economic impact of tax incentives. And a great report seems to have been issued just recently, last day of last year, on economic development tax incentives and looking at what their impact is and finds that most of them don't pay for themselves, at least in the way they measured. And they took some really hard look. There are other aspects probably to think about, but how are you thinking about putting into action, if there is, some of the suggestions there with regard to taking a hard look at these tax expenditures for economic development?
I think the Division of Budget is looking at this report pretty closely. There's a mixed bag of through that report. There are some tax incentives that we provide from the state that are really, really effective, like the Excelsior job program. But then there's others that are less so. I think we're obviously willing to have that dialogue. Some of these tax expenditures, though, that you do, some of the tax relief measures, you know, I kind of think of like, I think it was like FDR said, if nothing else, do something, right? That I think in some places, particularly in upstate New York, there are some tax expenditures that are out there as a lure to attract the business that maybe on net the state benefit isn't that wonderful, but if it was the difference between going from one county to the other, you know, one county was more poised to offer it and then they secured the jobs. It's an imperfect science. You're trying to put something out there that that businesses can avail themselves of and bring jobs to communities. But at the same time, if they're not effective and they're not necessarily doing the trick, then they're obviously willing to have that discussion as we move forward. I think there's also there's a whole other discussion on the effectiveness of you know, one that came up was the film tax credit, which is one that, again, is sort of people in the city of New York. You maybe hate the parking issues that film shoots create, but it's not. Some people like to see that in their community. They like to see that activity. They like to see the spinoff. They like to see that their bodegas are being utilized. They're, you know, they like to see that they're that just that activity. Sometimes it doesn't translate to a state dollar, but it's something that people tend to want to see. So,
and first of all, Tax and Finance commissioned the study. They released it. It's sober. It's incredible that they did it. We've all seen, at times, the public sector seem to whitewash and put their thumbs. It's really actually a good report. So thanks to the governor and Amanda and everyone who did that. I mean, you said it's an imperfect science. The first thing is it would be good to have science. Kent.
Thanks. Thanks for being here. I'd like to return to the temporary income tax surcharge that Andrew mentioned in passing. Didn't quite press you on it. So when was that enacted? In 2020?
2021.
2021. And now it's expected to, it's scheduled to expire in 27. So if you mentioned that the governor is committed to keeping taxes low to keep New York competitive, is the governor committed to allowing that surcharge to expire? And if she is, what direction is she giving your team to put the budget on a glide path to be able to accommodate that, as opposed to arguing about it when you're preparing the 2028 budget and having to deal with that cliff?
Well, so if you look at your budget gaps, it actually assumes that it goes away. So we plan for it. On the Division of Budget always looks at sort of current law, and we reflect that in our policy. I think that it's going to be an iterative process. One, as we get into those years, we have to see how the extent to which our base revenues have rebounded and actually revisit the question. When it was enacted, when the surcharge was enacted, A lot of the resources that were derived from it were pledged to public schools in particular, to pay off foundation aid. So as time goes on, you know, sort of built into the base, but other tax revenues, baseline revenues also are improving. So we want to make sure we're keeping a close eye on it. I know the governor's committed to not raising taxes PIT in this current year, and it's something that I don't think it's in her mind in any way, shape, or form in the out years to increase it further than what it is today. But is in terms of decreasing that or any other tax, you know, it's just going to be a sort of a game time decision. Look where we are at the moment in time and then see if we can adjust accordingly. And again, we also have a legislature that, you know, stay tuned. But in a month from now, there's going to be lots of creative energy on taxes, lots of novel ideas. For new taxes, and we want to try to avoid a lot of those as well. So,
I had already said yes to Tom and then Judy. Tom. Creative energy. I love that. I love that. You know, there's the long list of creative energy, including, frankly, using the reserve funds that the governor has led building up.
Yes.
So hold the line on those, please, Tom.
So one of the areas of additional spending we haven't talked about is infrastructure, maybe a bit in terms of cap and invest. But you look at the New York MTA, we had leadership here at the last CBC board meeting talking about, you know, even with congestion pricing passing, the 20-year needs assessment will identify additional needs and funding needs that the New York MTA will have. I mean, what are your thoughts in terms of infrastructure funding, right? You know, just to, one, to keep the MTA going, but then you have mega projects like Penn Station and other IBX and expansion programs of that type. And, you know, what is the state's thinking in that regard in terms of raising additional revenue? And then sort of related to that, how do you think about the share between city and state funding of the New York MTA, and is that a potential solution?
So I think in general, just looking over the last 2 years of Governor Hochul's term, as far as capital investments, we did look back of 25, 30 years, and there's no governor that's put more budget, more money into the budget on capital than Governor Hochul. So it's actually, that relates to the DOT capital plan, resources to the MTA, and then all a host of stuff, various and sundry across the state, including $6 billion to SUNY and CUNY alone. So there's a lot out there, and we're doing that at a time where we're maintaining affordability throughout the plan period, well beyond the plan period into the future. The governor feels very, very strongly that we want to make sure that we're competitive in the capital markets. I think that certainly our, you know, holding onto reserves and showing persons that engage with the state of New York that we actually have we have sufficient liquidity to bolster all of our own expenditures, really, really important to us. But as far as it relates to the expenditures of the MTA, the last capital plan of the MTA, I think the state of New York provided about $8 billion in new resources. The current has about 3.5, if memory serves. And the current budget also, the current plan for the MTA includes congestion pricing, which is very much, it's still planning to go forward, but there's just lots of litigation around it. As far as the state's additional commitment to the MTA, we know it's the lifeline of the city of New York. It's something that the governor will not allow the city to grind to a halt. But we have to wait and see, see how things start to shape out. We do have some commitment levels, certainly on many of the projects you have mentioned, the mega projects in the MTA. Also, want to see growth, and the governor wants to see targeted investments that make sense for individual communities. But then she also, with the MTA, she's been pushing them on ADA improvements and just the ordinary customer experience, because there's a whole host of examples, probably in some of your own communities, where, you know, four flights up, no elevator to catch a train. So there's those fundamentals we don't want to lose sight of either. And it's really important. It's something we maintain a constant dialogue with the MTA on.
I think you're right. Part of next year's budget will come to, you know, that discussion. Judy. Hold on, you're going to get a microphone in 1 second.
That's okay. Hi. Again, thank you so much for coming and for your remarks. A quick question on an update of where the stimulus dollars are, plans on spending them by 26?
Sure. So the state of New York receives all sorts of forms of stimulus, but the one that is sort of the most liquid for us was we received about $13 billion in a state, local governments received similar assistance. The state of New York received about $13 billion. We split it over three fiscal years. 25 is the last year that we're drawing down on it. So we're basically just clearing the deck. We're pledging those expenditures towards any number of state agency operating expenses. We have in our financial plan, we plan for those to have gone away after 25. We adjust accordingly. Long story short, we're proceeding on pace. We're not going to turn back any resources that could be a problem in some other states, but we're doing just fine. And we didn't take on recurring expenditures with it. It's just an offset to the general fund.
Well, thank you for both continuing the tradition, the longstanding tradition, and for helping us dive a little deeper than sometimes we get to in the public debate about the budgets. We look forward to continuing to work together. We have no shortage of ideas that we'll communicate.
Please,
but I will say for all of you, this administration, and since Blake's been involved, the communication has even gotten better. So thank you very much for that, and thanks for being here today.
Thank you. Thank you.
Bye.